Lecture 2, Wordsworth and the Lyrical Balance.
We now begin a sequence of four lectures on the poet whom many of us regard as the most important writer of the past two centuries, under whose capacious wings we still find protection, and under whose inspiration most Anglo-American poetry has developed. Wordsworth has never been an easy sell, and this is due both to the peculiarities of his verse and to the figure of the poet himself, a man who in no way inspires the immediate sense of intimacy that you get when reading, for example, Lord Byron. Wordsworth is not the first poet whom one would like to have a meal with. That distinction would go to the more energetic and open Keats, or even to Coleridge, a wonder of talkativeness and opinions, who impressed everyone who ever met him with his volubility, brilliance, and occasional generosity, in spite of his all too evident human imperfections. No, Wordsworth was not a clubbable man. He was often dour, silent, seemingly aloof in his sense of his own superiority. And the coldness of the man often presents itself in the poetry, which Keats memorably characterized as, I'm quoting Keats, the egotistical or Wordsworthian sublime. He's not for everyone's tastes. If Byron was, in the famous assessment, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, Wordsworth, whom Matthew Arnold linked with Byron as the two poets who would be remembered at the end of the 19th century, has struck many readers as sane, haughty, and impossible to know. The man who called the poet a man speaking to men in the preface to the second edition of Lyrical Ballads in 1800, that most important document in the history of English aesthetics, often seems troublingly opaque. Much of his work is as unassimilable as the man himself. Biographers divide Wordsworth's life into two pieces. The first half, which represents his growth, his conflicts, and his creative energies, followed by a second half in which the former rebel and innovator gradually came to be replaced by an increasingly conservative, orthodox, even stodgy old man, a Church of England believer. And finally, upon the death of Robert Southey in 1842, the poet laureate, whom Robert Browning from the next generation memorably lamented. Browning said, "Just for a handful of silver he left us, just for a ribbon to stick in his cloak." What happened to produce such a momentous decline? Wordsworth was born in Cumberland in England's Lake District in 1770. He was the second of five children to Anne and John Wordsworth. His father was an attorney and the chief law agent for Sir James Lowther. In other words, he came from a solid, middle-class, conservative family to whose status he returned in the second half of his life after a somewhat troubled radical youth. His mother died when he was seven, and the children were farmed out to various relatives. Among the five siblings, William was especially close to his brother John and to his sister Dorothy, who was 18 months his junior, from whom he was separated for a nine-year period when he was shipped off to school. He went up to St. John's College, Cambridge, where he was not a particularly distinguished student. In the summer of 1790, he did what many contemporary American students might do. He took a walking tour in Europe, in France. With the difference, of course, that the Bastille had been stormed exactly 1 year before. And coming to France with his friend Robert Jones, he felt that he was arriving in a new world. The early promise of the French Revolution had filled liberals, especially young people, with hope and excitement. Wordsworth returned to France after completing his degree and probably was involved there and subsequently in London in radical political circles. He also had an affair with a French widow named Annette Vallon, by whom he sired a child, and whom he probably would have married had not the growing hostilities between France and England made it difficult, if not impossible, for him to return to France. The years between 1793 and 1798 were spent in confusion, the kind of confusion typical of young people today, confusion about a career, about money, about family, about sex, and so forth. A small legacy from his friend Raisley Calvert, who died in 1795, gave Wordsworth some degree of financial freedom. And that same year he met Coleridge, who was clearly the major influence on his creative and imaginative life. It has been said, in fact, that Coleridge's greatest work was Wordsworth, that without the overseeing inspiration of his junior friend, Wordsworth would not have blossomed so quickly into the great poet he became. Collaborating with Coleridge, he produced the first volume of Lyrical Ballads in 1798 and then traveled to Germany in 1798 with Coleridge and Dorothy, settling into Goslar in the Harz Mountains during the coldest winter of the century, and at this time began piecing together the long work that eventually took shape over the next 7 years as his great verse autobiography, The Prelude, to which we will return in lectures 4 and 5. By 1802, he had returned to the Lake District, married an old childhood friend, Mary Hutchinson, and settled down at the age of 32 to become a paterfamilias. Two of his 5 children died young, and increasingly a national figure and a person whom visitors wanted to meet. His greatest creative work was essentially finished in 1814, 1 year after he became distributor of stamps for Westmoreland, an office that paid him between £400 and £500 per year. And he spent the remaining 35 years of his life writing poetry that was more conventional than that of his earlier years and fussing with The Prelude, which remained unpublished at his death in 1850. Wordsworth's great creative years were the decade between 1797 and 1807, and it is to the poetry of that decade that we shall devote the rest of these lectures. Wordsworth is a poet at once commonplace and sublime, and as such he inspires feelings of doubleness or ambiguous responses. Byron referred scathingly to the simple Wordsworth, by which he did not intend a compliment. He meant simple-minded Wordsworth. But simplicity is not the same as simple-mindedness, and Wordsworth's poems are often deep in their simplicity, just as, to take an opposing example, Ezra Pound's complex modern works can often seem stunningly shallow. In his preface to the second edition of Lyrical Ballads, Wordsworth says that his goals include the reformation of the language of poetry, his intention to use the language really spoken by men and women. That is, he wishes to effect changes in diction, the kind of change that poetry undergoes regularly as one fashion becomes outmoded and worn out. He also calls poetry, in a famous formula, the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, and says that a poem takes, I'm quoting, its origin in emotion recollected in tranquility. His second major aim is to trace the primary psychological laws of human nature, with special reference to how the mind associates ideas in a state of excitement. He says he wants to take real human incidents and, quote, to throw over them a certain coloring of imagination whereby ordinary things should be presented to the mind in an unusual aspect, to make these incidents and situations interesting by tracing in them the primary laws of our nature. In other words, he's proposing a democratization of the language and the subjects of poetry and a philosophical plumbing of the depths of human nature. Coleridge, writing about the collaboration with Wordsworth, had this to say in his Biographia Literaria. I'm quoting Coleridge. During the first year that Mr. Wordsworth and I were neighbors, our conversations turned frequently on the 2 cardinal points of poetry, the power of exciting the sympathy of the reader by a faithful adherence to the truth of nature, and the power of giving the interest of novelty by the modifying colors of the imagination. The sudden charm which accidents of light and shade, which moonlight or sunset diffused over a known and familiar landscape, appeared to represent the practicability of combining both. It was agreed that my endeavors should be directed to persons and characters supernatural or at least romantic, yet so far as to transfer from our inward nature a human interest and a semblance of truth sufficient to procure for these shadows of imagination that willing suspension of disbelief which constitutes poetic faith. You can hear in Coleridge's use of the romantic something of what I spoke of in the last lecture. Here we have a summary of many of the individual points that I have made and which are the basis for so much of English romanticism. Nature and imagination make a pair of complementary opposites. Wordsworth and Coleridge collaborate. The first, working on ordinary life and rendering it more exotic. The latter, taking the exotic and bringing it down to the level of believability. Remember, the two bookends of the lyrical ballads are The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, that Gothic poem of supernatural mystery and inexplicable crimes on the one hand, and Tintern Abbey, Wordsworth's autobiographical reminiscence and philosophical speculation that begins with an actual spot on the Welsh border. The very title, Lyrical Ballads, gives us some clues to its author's intentions and to its place in the history of English poetry. A ballad is traditionally a narrative poem written in what are called ballad stanzas. It's usually anonymous. We associate ballads in any language with the beginnings of national identity. They're like folk songs, and they tell simple tales in a bare, almost ascetic style. A lyric, on the other hand, is more personal, usually has a first-person speaker, and it tends to deal with personal emotions and states of mind. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner is an updated ballad. It's an attempt to recreate a more antique and mysterious form. And several of Wordsworth's contributions to the volume use the ballad form but update it to render incidents from everyday rural life. Many of Wordsworth's poems contain the simple pieties for which he has been praised and derided in equal measure. In one, called Expostulation and Reply, he jousts intellectually with Matthew, who's an older teacher figure, and who urges him to read and study deeply, but to whom he defends his apparent wasteful idleness. He says, "The eye, it cannot choose but see. We cannot bid the ear be still. Our bodies feel, where'er they be, against or with our will. Nor less I deem that there are powers which of themselves our minds impress, that we can feed this mind of ours in a wise passiveness." Notice here two hallmarks of Romanticism. First, Wordsworth's inheritance from John Locke of the language of sensationalism, how the powers of nature figuratively impress themselves upon the tabula rasa of the mind. Second, how passive experience is an educational tool allowing us to grow and prosper. In the following poem, called The Tables Turned, Wordsworth urges Matthew to leave his books and to listen instead to the music of the throstle, one of those romantic birds who are really teachers in disguise. "Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher." Many of these poems offer both charming platitudes and characters who seem to exist on the margins of society or of consciousness. Wordsworth was fascinated throughout his life with such figures, children, old men, beggars, poor people. And his fascination owes a great deal to his psychological and political radicalism. What do we owe to the poor? What can we learn from them? These are questions that many of the poems in this volume pose. Some of them do it in a relatively straightforward manner, urging upon their readers Wordsworthian versions of Christian charity. But never pity, an emotion that Wordsworth, like Blake, came to detest. Blake wisely said, "Pity would be no more if we did not make somebody poor." No. Instead, Wordsworth urges us to honor the humanity of even so marginal a figure as the old Cumberland beggar, who walks along, regardless and unfeeling, but who brings an entire community to a consciousness of its collective purpose and humanity by showing us that, quote, "we have all of us one human heart." For all the eccentricity of many of the characters in these poems, Wordsworth's main theme is community, or the relations among disparate creatures who seem to have little or nothing to do with one another. This is very radical. In addition to the relatively simple poems and lyrical ballads, both the first and then the second expanded edition of 1800, there are others that are more complicated, both in their thought and in their reworkings of poetic form or figurative language. Take, for example, a pair called The Two April Mornings and The Fountain, in both of which the Wordsworth figure goes up against Matthew, the old village schoolmaster, in a philosophical argument that is both simple and deep. In the first poem, we have a complicated time scheme in which the village schoolmaster expresses surprise that this April day is exactly like a previous one 30 years before, when he came to the grave of his daughter Emma, who had been dead for 9 years. And turning from the grave, he sees another blooming girl who is herself another mirror image, like the day and the cloud and the season. This time, she's an image of the dead daughter. In the penultimate stanza, Matthew acknowledges, "There came from me a sigh of pain, which I could ill confine. I looked at her and looked again, and did not wish her mine." In other words, a loss cannot be compensated for, even or especially, by that which most resembles it. Wordsworth is working with two related themes. The first concerns human consciousness and psychology and how we deal with grief. The second is the idea of poetic figuration. After all, metaphor and simile, comparisons, are the basis of poems. Things resemble one another in differing degrees. And as it is with human life and human relationships, so it is also with poetic constructions. Things resemble, but can never fully stand in for or become other things. Loss is irreplaceable. Comparisons are never the same as identity. In The Fountain, Matthew laments the fact that he is old and bereft of friends and family. The wiser mind, he says, the wiser mind mourns less for what age takes away than what it leaves behind. Our memory of past joy is both a blessing and a curse, because we're constantly aware of what has been taken. And in a statement at once transparent and very deep, Matthew acknowledges that, quote, "My life has been approved, and many love me, but by none am I enough beloved." I wonder, how much is enough? How much love does a human being need in order to survive? The Wordsworth figure volunteers to become a surrogate child. He says, "Matthew, for thy children dead, I'll be a son to thee." At this he grasped my hand and said, "Alas, that cannot be." A loss, in other words, once endured, can never be undone, however much we may try to fill a void. So Wordsworth's twin interests, human psychology and the association of ideas, on the one hand, and poetic diction or linguistic associations, on the other hand, work together. At the same time, for the poet whom we normally associate with the natural world and with the blessings that nature can bestow upon him, there's a troubling, quite modern response to nature that comes from a different perspective. In a poem called Nutting, which was originally part of the long autobiographical sequence that became the prelude, Wordsworth complicates his memories of childhood and of nature. The poem treats a child's unbridled freedom and active course. Wordsworth ultimately classified the poem in subsequent printings of his poetry among the exalted title Poems of the Imagination, as if wishing to prove something about the relationship between a sense of morality and the childhood pleasures of stealth and destructiveness. In this poem, written in Miltonic blank verse, Wordsworth combines the grandeur of Milton's epics with the ordinariness of the bohemian adventures of a 10-year-old boy. The young boy goes out for a walk in the woods. He's done up in rags, and he comes upon a certain grove. Notice the manipulation of language and the undertones of something more than mere nature appreciation in the following lines. "O'er pathless rocks, through beds of matted fern and tangled thickets, forcing my way, I came to one dear nook unvisited, where not a broken bough drooped with its withered leaves, ungracious sign of devastation, but the hazels rose tall and erect, with tempting clusters hung, a virgin scene." Sexual suggestions have been planted. The boy is forcing his way into a scene that is virginal and Edenic, and like Eden, tempting to him. What is the temptation to or for? The boy sits and watches, voluptuously observing the scene and relishing its beauties and his power. A sense of false, inflated generosity fills him up until at last, and here are the poem's concluding 12 lines. Then up I rose and dragged to earth both branch and bough with crash and merciless ravage, and the shady nook of hazels and the green and mossy bower, deformed and sullied, patiently gave up their quiet being. And unless I now confound my present feelings with the past, ere from the mutilated bower I turned exulting, rich beyond the wealth of kings, I felt a sense of pain when I beheld the silent trees and saw the intruding sky. Then, dearest maiden, move along these shades in gentleness of heart, with gentle hand touch, for there is a spirit in these woods. Much in this section is characteristically Wordsworthian, and it's troubling for that. The boy is characterized as a rapist. He has mercilessly ravaged the hazel bower in an act of youthful bravado. The sense of a child's potential criminality was always on Wordsworth's mind during these years, and in addition to its fidelity to his own sense of himself as a young boy, it may have owed something to his feelings about and participation in the events in France and England associated with the tumult of the French Revolution. In any case, the picture Wordsworth paints of himself here and in the prelude in general includes moments like this of what we would call modest juvenile delinquency. He dresses this up in the style of English heroic poetry, thereby lending it a seriousness of purpose that had never been accorded to childhood before this time. Wordsworth both glories in and is ashamed by his youthful adventures. I'm especially taken by the use of the adverb patiently to describe how the bower gave itself over to the boy. Of course, trees have no volition, and so they have little chance or little choice but to give in. Fighting back is not a realistic possibility. But the woods are personified, too, so their patience is a sign that they realize, first of all, that this is the kind of stuff that little boys do, and next, that their own limbs and leaves will in fact grow back in subsequent seasons. Readers have always been struck here, as in Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner, by the relationship of a final tag line, a moralizing gesture, we might call it, with the adventure and the story that precede them. And we'll discuss the relationship of a moral to the Ancient Mariner in Lecture 7. Wordsworth wishes to impress upon himself and upon his reader the way in which a human conscience and consciousness comes into being. He's honest about the inability to remember. He says, unless I now confound my present feelings with the past, and this inability to remember is a major concern. But after the event, or so he says he recalls, he felt a sense of pain. The rapist feels guilt as he beholds what he calls the intruding sky. What a wonderful combination of adjective and noun that is. The sky is intruding because the boy has ripped away at the protective fabric that made a canopy of the trees. The hole now allows the sky and the sun to peer down at the guilty party. But of course, the real intruder is the young Wordsworth himself, so his figurative language implicates him as much as his own professions of feeling. The moral of the poem sounds an awful lot like an admonition, please don't walk on the grass, as he urges upon a fictive reader, the dear maiden whom he addresses, the lesson that he's learned. Is this the sum total of his knowledge? Certainly not. The poem has given us a Sunday school tagline, but it has attached it to a tale of sexual criminality, which is entirely natural. This is what little boys do. So any urging of a reader or listener to walk piously and gently through the woods is going to fall, at least in part, on deaf ears. One thing is obvious. Wordsworth believed in the educative value of landscape. In fact, the subheading of Book 8 of the Prelude is called Love of Nature Leads to Love of Man, a formula that readers who are impressed with Wordsworth's misanthropic side might wish to contest. In any case, the landscapes Wordsworth favors, even one like the hazel bower in Nutting, let alone the starker mountainous landscapes that fill his reminiscences of the Lake District or of traveling in Wales and France, all represent places of peril with suggestions of infinity and images of exposure. There is always something relentlessly sublime about them, even when they seem benign and pastoral. We may observe this connection between nature and danger, or even between life and death, in a sonnet written in 1802, composed upon Westminster Bridge. Wordsworth and Dorothy were taking a carriage to leave London in order to visit Annette Vallon and Wordsworth's young daughter Caroline in France during a temporary suspension of the hostilities between England and France, and also, I might say, to bid them farewell because Wordsworth was about to marry his childhood sweetheart, Mary Hutchinson. The sonnet is as follows. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare. Ships, towers, domes, theaters, and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep in his first splendor valley, rock, or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt, a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still. Wordsworth does exactly what he and Coleridge talked about doing in their poems. He's taken a commonplace event, the beauty of a perfect, still morning picture, and complicated or deepened it. Things begin to look like their opposites. The city is paradoxically clothed, wearing the beauty of the morning like a garment. But it is also, of course, naked. All of the artifice and architecture of the city, human constructions like ships, towers, domes, theaters, and temples lie open and suggest vulnerability as they merge with or into the fields and the sky. In other words, nature and culture, or nature and the city, a famous pair of dichotomies, blur into one another. And the deep calm that communicates itself to the speaker suggests other kinds of depths. The houses, like the people within them, seem asleep. And that mighty heart, the heart of the city as a personified object, that mighty heart, like the individual hearts of its citizens, is lying still. The city is most beautiful when it is clothed and naked. It is most beautiful when it is most like a corpse. Death seems to linger not far beneath the surface, even in a poem celebrating the dawning of a new day. Wordsworth was well aware of such paradoxical connections. He was attuned to childhood blessedness and criminality, just as he was aware, even before the current fashion of today for ecological consciousness, of the ways in which humankind is an intrusive presence in the natural world. His simple pieties are, in other words, everywhere complicated by his sense that things can be more troubled and troubling than they initially appear, just as his simple language can reveal depths of poetic association that are the mark of an original imagination. In the next lecture, we'll look at a mysterious series of poems known as the Lucy Poems, and then move on to his two greatest lyrics, Tintern Abbey and the Ode, Intimations of Immortality.